You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help.
We're joined virtually today by H. Keith Melton, an internationally recognized intelligence historian and authority on espionage technology. Keith is the author of Ultimate Spy: Inside the Secret World of Espionage, and co-author of Spycraft: The Secret History of the CIA's Spy Tech from Communism to Al-Qaeda. And he wrote that book with Bob Wallace. And Bob Wallace is joining us today as well. Bob is the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency's Office of Technical Service. He's also a founder of the Artemis Consulting Group and contributor to the CIA's Center for the Study of Intelligence. Bob has written five books with Keith Melton, including Spy Sites of Washington, D.C. I should add that Bob is on Spy Museum's advisory board. Keith is on Spy Museum's governing board. Keith also has notably donated over 5,000 artifacts to the International Spy Museum. So, gentlemen, let's have a conversation about your recent book titled Spy Sites of New York City. So you guys have authored several books together, but I have to ask you right up front, why did you decide to put together this book? This is not your first Spy Sites book. You've done Spy Sites in D.C., and clearly a lot of work went into that. And now you've added The City That Never Sleeps. Bob, before we go any further, I want to ask you, which one is your favorite? I want to put you on the spot.
Chris, thank you for inviting us to be part of this program. I would refer, I believe, to my mother in answering your question. My mother had 14 nephews, and each time that she would introduce one of her nephews to somebody else, she would say, "This is my favorite nephew, Dennis. This is my favorite nephew, Sean. This is my favorite nephew," add the name. And I'm sort of like this, like that with these two books. You know, this is my favorite book. Today, we're talking about New York. It's absolutely my favorite book. If we do an interview about Washington tomorrow, it will absolutely be my favorite book. And that is no discredit to either of them. I would add very quickly, though, that it's also not unlike what's my favorite artifact in the Spy Museum. And so it's my favorite artifact, the miniature camera. Is it the rat concealment? Is it the umbrella with the poison dart? Hey, you know, the answer is yes.
Keith, how about you?
Well, I like Bob's analogy. I'm reminded, I believe, the kind of the allegorical reply that Willie Sutton, the infamous bank robber, once said, "Why do you rob banks?" And his answer was, "Because that's where the money is." Well, I think Bob and I, if we want to write stories and books about spies and you want to write sites, well, the center of espionage in the United States have traditionally been in two cities, Washington, D.C. and New York City, going back to the American Revolution, and add Philadelphia as the third. So in that order, we have written them. And I would say that New York City, certainly with a number of spies there at the United Nations and undercover, it rivals Washington. It would be hard to pick a favorite between the two.
Well, the book is exhaustively researched. I've clearly looked at all of your books, and this one in particular is incredibly researched. You have 233 main entries. You have 380 photographs. So I'm going to ask you a little easier question. Was it easier to do this book because you've worked together, you and Bob, for so many years? You've been such great partners. Was it easier to put together this book just because of your time spent working these kinds of books together? Bob?
Chris, this is a question to me that is similar to one that I faced several times during my career at the CIA, and that was moving and being reassigned and relocating. And over those years, I finally came to the conclusion that moving never got any easier. But I didn't know what to expect each time.
Right.
And I think that's the case with these books. Each one has its individual challenges. Each one takes a tremendous amount of effort. We put that in. They were difficult. I don't think they were easier, but we sure knew what to expect, and we kind of knew what problems to anticipate.
Is that about right, Keith? Is that how you feel about it?
Well, certainly. I would add to it that Bob and I have been working together for almost 20 years and friends before that. But we've been working on books. We both have an appreciation for historical detail. And we've also been aided by Hank Schlesinger, who is our long-term friend and researcher. And he adds immeasurably to the quality of our books by some of the arcane sights and perspective he brings. He's a New Yorker, a native New Yorker. He knows New York. And as he always reminds us, only a New Yorker would know some of these things. So the combination continues to serve us well.
So either one of you can answer this question. I'm just curious, did you find out anything unexpected about spying from your foray into New York City?
I'll offer a suggestion is, I think, and Bob and I talked, we were amazed at the proliferation of German espionage during World War I, mm-hmm. and how they were both, on one hand, trying to subvert U.S. public attention to keep the U.S. out of the war, but on the other hand, the number of acts of sabotage to destroy the munition pipeline that was essentially keeping England and France fighting in World War I. And the scale of their operations are still astounding. And keep in mind, this took place at a time that we really didn't have a FBI with national powers to serve in a counterintelligence needs and function. So the U.S. was essentially unprepared for global espionage at that point.
Chris, I think a piece that I hadn't realized was the extent to which influence operations, propaganda, efforts to influence the American public's opinion of circumstances of politics, played such a significant role from the beginning of our country. And we've heard about that a lot in the last 3 or 4 years about, quote, foreign influence in affecting American public opinion. But in fact, one of the things that the New York book really underscored is that activity began with the Revolution. And it's been a factor in every era of American espionage since then. To have that underscored in the way that the various entries in the New York book have done was something of a revelation to me.
And I think that's a great point. I think that right now, propaganda, disinformation, it's very much in the media. And it's a great reminder that disinformation, misinformation, propaganda campaigns have been around throughout history. So it goes beyond, well beyond the Cold War. So thanks for bringing that up. I'd like to dive a little bit into the American Revolution. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the Turtle Attack. So Bob, going back to you, can you highlight the story that we talk about because it's so relevant to the Spy Museum?
The Turtle was the name given to a submersible, or at least partial submersible, that was built by an American scientist named David Bushnell in the Revolutionary War, in the early part of the Revolutionary War, designed as an attack vehicle, as a clandestine, secret attack vehicle on the British warship that was moored in lower Manhattan. And Bushnell conceived of a sphere that is replicated to the best as we can in the lobby of the Spy Museum. And the idea would be that powered by a hand crank and a screw propeller, this submersible would be pedaled up, if you will, to the ship, to the warship, and an explosive planted on the hull of the warship and detonate it and sink the warship. There were a couple of elements of it that I think are relevant to intelligence. One, it was a great engineering feat, and it was a successfully completed and built device. Secondly, as an NCO in the Army, I can understand the idea that the scientist is not about to drive that boat into the mission. So they found a sergeant willing to get inside the boat and pedal it up to the warship. And next, from an intelligence standpoint, they had incomplete intelligence on the British warship because they had expected the warship to be a wooden hulled ship, and in fact, it had a metal hull on it. So they were unable to drill the hole that was necessary to plant the explosive on the ship. Well, the Turtle returned to port, mission not accomplished, but in fact, we had demonstrated the capability to build a device, a submersible device, that potentially could attack an enemy warship.
I love that story. I'd like to shift gears to Francis Tavern, and I'd like to just highlight for Keith and you, Bob, that happens to be my favorite historical site in New York as it relates to espionage, because it really bridges the Revolutionary War and spying with terrorism. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that, Keith. Tell us about the history of Francis Tavern. Still running, by the way.
It is. It was originally... before it was called the Francis Tavern, it was the Queen's Head Tavern. And in 1762, they changed the name, and it became somewhat infamous as the meeting place of the Sons of Liberty. So it clearly was aligned with a kind of the revolutionary cause. General Washington gave it notoriety because it became his last residence in New York City. And in the dining room in 1783, he gave his final farewell address to his officers. So it has a long history. Furthermore, the Francis, who was a Jamaican that owned the tavern, his daughter Phoebe worked for General Washington as a housekeeper and is credited by being very alert and detecting one of his bodyguards that was a traitor. And actually she reported a plot that could have resulted in the loss of his life. I think, and most significantly, in 1975, a Puerto Rican independence group, the FALN, planted bombs there that killed four people. So sadly, there was the nexus of terrorism and espionage, but the site is still there. It's certainly worth visiting, and it's a New York landmark.
So before we shift to the Civil War, I'd be remiss if I didn't flag the AMC TV show Turn, Washington Spies, because that show has really highlighted just how much espionage played out in New York City and Long Island, in Connecticut for that matter. Talk a little bit about the Culper spy ring and the connection to some of the sites. Could you do that a little bit for us, Bob? Tease it out.
Well, I'll start with the Culper spy ring, saying that this is one of those operations with multiple people, and one really can't understand the operation unless you have a scorecard with the people involved. The principal organizer of the ring was Benjamin Talmadge, who was an aide to General Washington, and probably more significantly, he was a friend of he was a friend of Nathan Hale. And so the execution of Nathan Hale made a dramatic impact on Talmadge. And as Washington's aide, he was given the authority, the responsibility to form a spy ring based out of New York that would provide Washington with information about the British deployments, movements, capabilities in New York at the time, first years of the Revolutionary War. The British occupied New York, so it was a principal, would be a principal intelligence target for Washington. So a group of half a dozen people based both in New York and on Long Island became part of this intelligence ring that was known as the Culper Ring. Culper actually was not the name of anybody. It was a code name chosen for the name of the ring that included Abraham Woodhull, Robert Townsend, and Caleb Brewster primarily. And the concept of the operation involved the collection of information about British capabilities in New York by Robert Townsend, who was the owner of a store that the British frequented in New York. This information was passed to Woodhull, who then took it across the water to Long Island, and it was picked up by Brewster and then delivered to Talmadge. Now, all of this information was encrypted, or it was produced with secret writing. It was transmitted in secret writing. Then once Talmadge had the information, he had the responsibility for bringing the secret writing into vision so it could be read. Now, there are any number of permeations on this. One is that there was a coding mechanism based on what kind of laundry was being hung out to dry by a lady on Long Island that would provide signal information as to when information was to be received or was being received. I think that an element of it is the tradecraft and the technology used in the operation. And Keith has, I know, some comments on that.
I think the television show, as many television shows, they take some liberties with some of the technology shown. And some of the things they show, while interesting, didn't happen until years after the revolution. But the principal things that they understood probably are the things that intelligence officers are trained today. They understood the fundamental necessity of compartmentalization, so that by using cover names and never cross-contaminating those or releasing them into parallel groups. They were able to compartmentalize their cells. To this day, some of the individuals still serve in silence. Fundamentally, their basic method of communication was what they called sympathetic stains or invisible inks. And their primary method of coding were book codes, where they would create a dictionary and essentially mm-hmm. then assign a number to that. And as long as there were only two copies of the dictionary, that the word ammunition may be 316, and they had a long alphabetical list, and they could communicate effectively. It isn't a foolproof system, but it worked very well. They used dead drops. They had clandestine meeting sites. They understood the work of agents and officers. So they were fundamentally grounded, and General Washington should be credited as America's first great spy master, because he personally directed many of these operations and became a form of asymmetrical warfare that gave us an advantage over the British. And it was really one of the few advantages we had during the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, really, and you make the point well. And I think at the Spy Museum, we talk a lot about the Culper Network and George Washington's role. So I encourage people to not only walk the sites in New York City, but come to the Spy Museum, and we provide more color.
I'd Chris, like to if I the, could interject
yeah, go ahead,
here,
Mark.
This certainly. Is one of these episodes, one of the entries in Spy Sites of New York, where there are several actual sites that one can visit in New York as well. The Brewster, the Caleb Brewster farmhouse, it still exists. There's a marker where the Woodhull home was. The Townsend home is Raynham Hall in New York, a historical site. And so in terms of one of the spy stories, spy entries in the book, this one is particularly rich with places where you can still see and, if you will, walk in the shoes of these spies.
Right, and that includes going to the gravesite of Abraham Woodhull, who would have been Samuel Culper Sr., correct?
Yes, Samuel Culper Sr. All of these members not only had the alias names, but they also had code numbers associated with them. Keith mentioned that not all have been identified. And one who has not been identified is Mystery Agent 335. Mystery Agent 335 is likely one of the women who was part of the ring. But if someone wants to, become a prominent author, doing a little research and identifying that woman would be a great benefit to all intelligence historians and the Spy Museum.
Yeah. Any educated guesses, or do we have to wait for the book?
Well, I think there's no more than speculation. I don't know whether any of the guesses are very accurate or not. Now, there's also some question about whether that all of this is true. Any of these spy stories, over time, they get mixed with a lot of myth as well as interpretation. And so always in the absence of hard documentation, there are many speculative elements to it.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
So that's a great segue to the Civil War, because I've talked a little bit about this with Keith. There was so much fiction written about Civil War espionage that I really didn't take it that serious, because I couldn't find the literature until the last couple decades. There's been some excellent books. One comes to mind by a guy by the name of Official, who wrote about Civil War espionage, and there are traces of espionage in New York City during the Civil War. One in particular got my attention, and that was, quote, "The Vast and Fiendish Plot," and it has something to do with P.T. Barnum. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, Keith, please. And then I would like to hear from both of you on just, you know, what are your favorite sites regarding the Civil War, or what do you want to talk about? Because again, I think it's hard to find traces to the Civil War. Much of the work was sensationalized, and it's only been the last, as I said, a few decades that I think that serious historians have really dived in on the Civil War. You might not agree with that. I'd love to hear from both.
Well, the Vast and Fiendish Plot was a Confederate operation in 1864 that essentially was in response to General Sherman's destructive march across Georgia, and literally he destroyed everything in his path. And so the decision was made was to sow disruption and literally cause a firebomb attack and burn down New York City. And and they selected a number of key hotels, and including the Barnum's Museum of Americana. They selected and obtained 12 dozen bottles of Greek fire, which was a highly combustible mixture that was very explosive. And the idea was to rent rooms in hotels. If New York wasn't the New York we know of late, though there have been a lot of fires most recently there, and in the Revolutionary War, it was so compact without building codes that a conflagration could have been created.
Chris, I think, so that's an interesting New York link. I think one of the things that we did find, and Keith may want to comment on this, is the Civil War really didn't touch New York like it did Washington and Philadelphia. Right. New York was too far away. There were no battles, Civil War battles around New York, and in fact, a lesser degree of espionage there. I mentioned that one of the New York did get sort of produce a celebrity spy, and the one that I particularly like is Pauline Cushman. Pauline Cushman's spy career can best be described, I think, in the title of her book that she wrote. Pauline Cushman was a well-known actress, and the title of her book is, stay with me on this now, Chris, The Life of Pauline Cushman, the Celebrated Union Spy and Scout, comprising her early history, her entry into the Secret Service of the Army of the Cumberland, an exciting adventure with the rebel chieftains and others while within enemy lines, together with her capture and sentence to death by General Bragg and final rescue by the Union Army under General Rosecrans. So our next Spy Sites book, we're going to try to duplicate the title of Cushman's autobiography.
That's fascinating. Actually, I didn't pick up on that. Thanks for sharing that. I want to transition a little bit to the what Keith alluded to, and that was the First World War and the Germans, saboteurs, and some of their involvement in New York City. So, Keith, I think you alluded to that or referenced it early on. So what would you like to talk about? What favorite sites, interesting sites?
Well, one's the magnitude, and I may have mentioned it earlier, but 125 named incidents of espionage that have or sabotage that can be now attributed to German espionage operations, sabotage operations, was the magnitude. Their primary purpose was the disruption of the munitions that were feeding Europe. And the explosion at Black Calm Island was at the time the largest peacetime explosion, I think, in the United States history. So it was a major explosion in which debris was blown for miles and miles and miles. All this because we essentially didn't have a national police force such as the FBI in operation at that point with the authority to deal with counterintelligence. And very capable individuals such as Captain von Rintelen, who arrived in 1915 with $500,000 and was given a free way to run intelligence operations and sabotage operations, and they were devastatingly effective. It is fortunate, we still to this day don't know some of the losses because they were planting bombs in among the coal and ships going out to sea, and you simply have ships disappearing. So the true story and the magnitude of it is probably only being realized in recent years as historians have dug into it.
When we talk about terrorism at the International Spy Museum, we talk about anarchists as well. You post 1919, the Red Scare, et cetera. You can go to Wall Street and see the deadliest terrorist attack on US soil that had happened prior to 1993, the first World Trade Center attack, and of course, 9/11. So what would you find if you went to Wall Street? Are there any vestiges of that? Is there any pieces of that attack that you can find on Wall Street today?
I don't know whether there are any actual pieces of the shrapnel or the explosive devices left. New York does a pretty good job of cleaning their streets. So I think probably in the 100 years since, they've picked up all the artifacts or the souvenirs. My guess is that that's what you're searching for here, Chris, right? Is another artifact for the spy museum, like a piece of the shrapnel from the bombing.
No, I was referencing actually it seems that there's scarring from the actual bomb.
Indeed, there is scarring on several buildings on Wall Street from those 1920 bombings. Keith and I were in New York right before the city closed down because of the COVID virus, and walked that street, and it's fascinating to think that how in 100 years, in some ways, life has changed to the point that we don't recognize it, and then in other ways, the mark of radicalism or disruption or terrorists, whatever term you want to use with it, are on Wall Street today, and I suspect they're on several other streets in New York as we speak from the recent actions of people who would rather destroy than build. The anarchists of the 1920, I think, were feared broadly across the United States, and the Attorney General at the time made a specific effort to root out the radicals or find the radicals, which were bombing not only New York but a number of other cities around the United States. So here we're coming off of the Great World War, and immediately the country is plunged into both a crisis of virus flu, Spanish flu, as well as the threat of anarchists. Now, I don't know, Chris, in terms of if this is an opportunity to make another point about World War II, or if you'd like to move on to another subject, that's fine as well.
Well, before we go to go ahead, Bob, and then we'll then I want to dive into the ice axe and the plot and the and Trotsky, which I know Keith loves to talk about appropriately because of his deep experience with that story, but the links to New York. But go ahead and finish up on
just let me World finish up then on World War One, because to me, and in some ways, this is the most fascinating part of the book, because World War One seemed to be the turning point for espionage in America. This kind of ushered in the modern age of espionage, and the elements that were indicative of that was that foreign intelligence operations, that is coordinated foreign intelligence operations, came to America by two countries, the Germans and the British. And they ran operations, significant operations, well-funded operations of collection, of sabotage, and influence across America, not just isolated in any one city. There was, as Keith mentioned, the realization that we didn't have a domestic counterintelligence service, and thus the slow emergence of the FBI. There was also the development of cryptology, or really code breaking, first in Washington, and then that activity moved to New York subsequently. The technology of the time became dramatically significant for intelligence. One of the major developments was the ability to put induction taps on the cables and the transatlantic cables that were carrying communications from Europe to the United States. And then finally, I think it's fascinating that the British developed an operation against the German ambassador in Washington, in which the British got a hold of some images, pictures, photographs of the ambassador with a couple of bathing beauties who were not his wife. And they distributed these broadly to the American press. And to my knowledge, this is one of the first examples of using images to shape public perception. Previously, you had had we had cartoonists, we had drawings, but now you have the magic of photography. And not only can you take photographs, you can crop photographs and print them, and then you can suggest what these photographs might mean, even if that's not the truth. So images used out of context appeared first during this time of the First World War. Just a few items, I think, that are sort of set the stage for modern espionage.
I think, as I recall, you'll find a picture of those women with the ambassador in spy sites in New York City. So Keith, can you talk a little bit about the ice axe and the plot to kill Trotsky? What's the convergence in New York City, and what will we find?
Well, when Leon Trotsky escaped from Norway and fled to Mexico City, on one hand, he believed he was leaving the den of espionage in Europe. In actuality, he was far closer to the most subverted administration and penetrated administration in U.S. history, which was the Roosevelt administration. And he was much closer to sophisticated Russian intelligence operations under the NKVD in New York City. And so the plots to kill Trotsky were essentially planned from New York City. And the essentially two plots, the May 24th raid in which Mexican muralist David Alfaro's Quirios led a group of Mexican bandits to storm Trotsky's compound. The individual that let them in the door, Robert Sheldon Hart, was the son of a wealthy New York City financier who had been recruited in New York by the legendary Russian illegal Grigolevich, and he opened the door and let him in. But when that operation failed, on May 29th, the ultimate assassin, Ramon Mercader, using the false papers as Frank Jackson, traveled to New York City with his mother, Caridad, who operated under the very clever codename Mother, and they met with Gaik Ovakimian, who was the chief Soviet illegal in the U.S., at the Hotel Pierpont, and they laid out the final plans that would assassinate Leon Trotsky on August the 20th, 1940. They gave him the money to do the final financing. They proposed an operation to him with three weapons, which would be a pistol, an iron rod, and a knife. And he ultimately selected an ice axe. But the whole key to his approach to the entourage was, how do you penetrate this small, close group of American bodyguards, by the way, which were recruited through the Socialist Workers Party, headquartered in New York City and financed by the Socialist Workers Party. But it was a lonely socialite, a young girl by the name of Sylvia Ageloff, graduate of Columbia University, family, her father was a realtor. And ultimately, she was set up to be seduced by the assassin. He established a common law marriage with her. And then when he moved to Mexico City under the guise of setting up an import-export business, she followed, and she became the bridge that introduced him eventually into the Trotsky household. And based on her establishing his bona fides, on the 20th of May, he was allowed to be alone with Trotsky. And as an ice climber, he drove a shortened ice climbing axe 2 3/4 inches into Trotsky's skull and killed him. So without New York, this would not have been possible. New York was also the headquarters for an operation called Operation Gnome, which tried unsuccessfully to spring Mercader from prison. And that was unsuccessful. It's hard to separate the assassination from all of the work that took place in New York City.
It was a sophisticated plot, and you articulated very well. You know the story, and we have the ice axe at the International Spy Museum. So please come and visit us and take a look at the actual ice axe that you can find here in DC. Secret sites of the secret bomb. What will we learn about the Manhattan Project in Manhattan, right, Bob?
Chris, there were several kind of amazing things to me as we developed this book. I had never really thought about the Manhattan Project, although it had the name Manhattan associated with it,
right?
As having the kind of link, really, it's the birthplace of the atomic bomb is not Los Alamos, and it's not Sandia, and it's not Oak Ridge. It's really New York. And I just had never thought previously about New York being the home, the birthplace of the atomic bomb. But in fact, the Manhattan Project headquarters was at 27 Broadway. And this was only one of at least 8 other major locations in New York where research and engineering on the device on nuclear weaponry and the physics associated with it, the engineering required, were occurring. Now, then as the project developed, it was then spread out across the United States. Many locations where there was active, where there was water, where there's rivers that were necessary to support the actual development of the material. So New York has a central part in it, both from the standpoint of the development of the atomic bomb and then from the loss of that secret of the atomic bomb. And we point out through various places in the book, people like Harry Gold, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, Martin Sobel, Klaus Fuchs, Robert Oppenheimer, others who were New Yorkers who were involved in one way or another in the loss of that technology, that atomic technology to the Soviet Union. Now, Keith and I have talked about this a little bit, and he has a couple of things to add.
Well, of all the interesting sites, the diversification across the U.S. of such an important project is amazing. But many New Yorkers or readers of the book may pass the Buddhist church on Riverside Drive and fail to notice the small statue standing silent, of course, of the founder of 13th century Buddhism. And the statue was present in Hiroshima when the bomb fell. And it was ultimately removed and stands sentinel in New York City. And it's perhaps a link to the bombing that people pass by each day without ever giving it a second thought.
Well, I did not know that, and I didn't pick that up. And I've read through the book two or three times, so it gives you a sense of how dense it is with information and gems about the Cold War and espionage generally. So I want to talk a little bit about Rudolf Abel and his dead drop site in Tyrone Park. My question is, will I be able to find that actual dead drop site? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's Rudolf Abel was, of course, the chief Russian illegal in the U.S. After World War II, he took over the Volunteer Network, which had been the network that penetrated the atomic bomb program and stole the secrets. And so he was charged with the remnants of it. And as every good Soviet intelligence officer, he had a plethora of sites, including the one on Tyrone Park. Yes, you can find it, but you got to look carefully because some of the elements of it has changed. But we do have some very good photos that you can use. And we've listed a number of both signal sites and drop sites that he used. One interesting story, because Abel was perhaps, his real name was with Willy Fisher, was the most technically sophisticated intelligence officer perhaps ever sent to the United States. He could make his own microdots, a skilled radio operator. But when I spoke with one of his instructors that was, we're still alive in the early 90s in Moscow, and I'm Colonel Nikolai, the head of their clandestine photography department. And I asked him, please tell me the names of his students that I would remember or I would know. And he, through the interpreter, said, well, I could give you the names of many of my students you would recognize because they became very famous because they did not pay attention and they got caught. The names I could give you of my students I'm most proud of, the ones that didn't get caught, of course I will not. But Fisher and Abel made one fatal mistake in that he revealed the location of his residence to his deputy, a man by the name of Rhino Hehanen, who eventually defected. And ultimately, after 6 weeks of driving through Brooklyn, they were able to pinpoint the hotel where he lived, and that ultimately led to Abel's arrest. So it was a significant case. And but once he was eventually swapped for Francis Gary Powers, and that was a story that you saw in the movie Bridge of Spies.
So he was a non-official cover officer, Abel. There's another non-official cover officer you talk about, and that's Jack Barsky. And I love the fact that there are five or six pages of his communications plan. First, I wanted to ask you, did Jack Barsky help you find those sites? Because we have a relationship with him at the Spy Museum. So talk a little bit about Jack's work and his communications plan and whether he helped you or not.
Jack was a great help. He is a friend of the museum and a historian. He's written a very important book, and he gave us full cooperation. So we, through a series of long interviews, were able to, from the literature in his book and his own memories, we were able to recover many of his communication sites. He was using a shortwave radio to receive one-way coded broadcasts. Plus, he was reporting using a Canon 35 millimeter camera and just photographing his reports and then dead dropping them. One that is most interesting to me was a site called Woody in Inwood Park that we believe what he left may still never have been recovered. It may still be there inside that rotted tree if someone ever chose to dig down in it. So the essence of espionage isn't high technology at times. It's still the fundamentals of signal sites, dead drops, clandestine meetings, and regular communication. And Jack is going to be a treasure, and I believe is soon going to be doing an evening presentation at the Spy Museum very, very soon.
I look forward to that. It is fascinating to walk that ground. Bob, anything on Jack? How long have you known Jack?
Chris, my knowledge of Jack is really through Keith, and so I don't have the same kind of additional insight to Jack and his work that Keith has.
How about Anna Chapman? Who knows that case?
It's probably going to be me with the Russian illegals, though I've never met Anna. Anna was a breed of what we call the new illegals, meaning that she was coming out in true name. And the reason was that these Russians have found out it is more difficult to protect digital cover in the world of the internet than it is to simply send someone out in true name and understand that there's no way for us to truly establish their bona fides and do research back in Moscow. And she came here in early 2010, was operational for up and through June of that year for 6 months. She lived at 20 Exchange Place. She had meetings, had a COVCOM sent signals every other Wednesday.
COVCOM.
Covert communication, and she was there to work her way, infiltrate the social ladder, make contacts, and kind of work her way to the top. Alan Kohler, the senior FBI case agent at the time, said that within 6 months, she would have been the most dangerous Russian spy in America because her ability to basically get into any man's office and get an audience with him and be able to make a pitch for, she was under cover of creating a apartment finders website, but she used her appearance to open doors and was very successful at it.
Well, I've got to say we covered a lot of ground, and I am actually shocked that we're on time because we covered from the American Revolution to really the new threats that exist today, ending with a discussion on Anna Chapman. Is there anything else, Bob? I'll turn to you first. Is there anything you want to cover that we didn't talk about today?
In terms of the New York book and drawing a little bit of contrast with our spy sites of Washington, Washington's book was heavily focused around people involved in the government. The diplomatic service and targets on the United States, various United States government agencies. New York emphasizes that spies are drawn from all walks of life. We have actors and academicians and technicians and machinists and the underworld. We have fashion models. We have writers. The list goes on and on. And these are all supported in New York primarily through commercial covers, stores like Townsend had, or the recording studio that the Russian intelligence officer Morris ran. Valerie Dickinson, who ran a doll shop and spied for the Japanese, Chapman with her real estate business. So those kinds of fascinating differences, I think, also underscore the pervasiveness of espionage and the creativity of intelligence services. So New York just adds a very rich dimension to our understanding of foreign as well as American intelligence operations.
Keith, final thoughts?
Well, it's certainly I echo Bob's comments. We ended on Anna Chapman, and I would say that is just the tip of the iceberg. At the museum, we have one of our most interesting displays is, I believe, the huge display we have on the handcuffs that arrested Anna Chapman and the 10 Russian illegals. The case was the impetus for the creation of the Emmy Award-winning and extremely popular series, The Americans. So any of the millions of American fans that want to know more about the real case, I hope they'll come and visit the museum when we reopen and take a look at some of the artifacts that Anna used and learn more about the real stories. As Bob and I often say, truth is really stranger than fiction. And when you see the true stories, the way we present them in the movies, in the museum, they certainly rival and surpass the fiction you often see on television and in movies.
Gentlemen, it's been an absolute privilege and a treat spending this afternoon with you talking about your book. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with our listeners and for your dedication to educating the public on espionage. I'm extremely grateful. I'm certainly a beneficiary of all of your hard work and all of your research on espionage. This book is an indispensable guide to New York's clandestine and subterranean history. Please check out the book, the book Spy Sites of New York City. Thank you. Have a great
day. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Good day. Bob.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.